Welcome to Beeline, your 95 BFM news podcast, delivering straight up news.
More rain is pelting down on an already flood-ravaged Northland.
A significant low-pressure system crosses New Zealand today. Watches and warnings are in effect.
The past week's weather has been the latest reminder that climate change-related severe weather threats are growing.
Kia ora, and welcome to this week's episode of Beeline on eco-anxiety. For young people, climate change and all its extreme weather events have been the backdrop of our entire lives, and an undeniable part of what the future will hold. As a young person, it can feel like an overwhelming and everlasting problem without a nearby solution. With climate politics flooded by climate denial and setbacks and critical deadlines that are frequently missed, it's easy to worry about what that will mean for the coming years. The term eco-anxiety has emerged to describe the chronic fear, distress, and worry brought about by environmental destruction. According to UNICEF, as many as 60% of young people regularly feel worried about climate change, and 75% are frightened for the future. With more and more young people suffering from this kind of anxiety, and some resigning themselves altogether to a nihilistic or defeatist attitude about the future, I had to ask myself, is this the only way we can look at this? Is optimism in the face of the climate crisis completely futile?
Climate change remains the greatest existential threat to Samoa and other Pacific cities.
It's the greatest con job ever perpetrated on the world, in my opinion.
The stakes could not be higher and the time could not be shorter.
To get some perspective on this topic, I'll be speaking to a range of experts, including a climate scientist, a policy analyst, and an eco-psychologist. But before all of them, I thought it best to talk to young people about their experience with eco-anxiety. In particular, rangatahi involved in climate activism, dealing with these topics every day.
We want climate action! We need climate action! This is our future! Let's make it happen!
In 2019, School Strike for Climate, led by activists around the world like Greta Thunberg, captured global attention for the climate crisis. My first interviewee was one of the activists I worked with in Australia, leading school strikes in Sydney.
Hi, my name is Farshi Yajman. I am a youth justice advocate, and basically my journey in the advocacy space has been primarily around climate change and mental health. So I was one of the organizers, along with several incredible people across Australia, and we mobilized 350,000 people in 2019, calling for climate action, calling for climate justice, and saying that we need better policies. And one thing that was really noticeable is that a lot of people in School Strike for Climate, and also a lot of people who are still doing climate activism today, got into it because they felt so much stress and anxiety over seeing the constant news cycle about these coal mines being approved, about the floods and bushfires and everything happening. So School Strike became this really great outlet for so many of us to be able to actually work through that anxiety.
That's interesting that you say that, actually. I hadn't thought about how climate activism was kind of an outlet for that anxiety. I did want to ask, you've obviously been involved in activism for a while now. Throughout that time, can you talk about how eco-anxiety in particular has affected you?
Yeah, I think it's really tricky because once you're in the space for a while, this sounds terrible, but you only start dissociating a little bit because it just feels like the same news again and again. But, you know, a study in like 2021 found that 80% of people between 16 to 25 are worried about climate change. And it is worrying to constantly see that number growing as well. And so I think for me, climate anxiety or eco-anxiety has just become part of the process, I guess, of being able to find different channels and different avenues and being like, how am I actually going to work through this? Because it's really easy to sit there and just wallow. And I definitely do have those days. But yeah.
I remember in my time doing School Strike and with AYCC as well, we talked a lot about people burning out really quickly from doing climate activism. I mean, obviously the statistics show that it's quite a widespread problem, but is in your circles, have you seen a lot of people experiencing both like eco-anxiety, but also just other attitudes of fear and rejection or even anger towards the climate crisis? And like, how do people deal with that? What are your observations about that?
I think burnout is so, so common, and you see it across all age groups. Like, there are such incredible activists who've been doing this work for decades who are just like, I am tired. I need to take a step back. And I think it precisely is doing that. It's taking a step back and saying, okay, if I want to be able to do this long term, then I need to take a step back now and actually take care of myself, because I think there has been like this, you know, like a pattern of growing anger, and then the government does something and it's like, okay, we're feeling better, and then they do something again and it's like a growing anger and resentment, and just like, I think there's a deep sense of frustration. But like we've seen in Australia, there's been, you know, a huge gas project approved a couple weeks ago, a coal mine extension was approved, and I think with all of that there also starts to become a little bit of apathy of like, I just can't care about it because it doesn't feel like anything is going to get better. And especially when you see climate change and cost of living and everything happening across the world like a genocide, it's really, really difficult to feel like you have any power at all. So I think the climate movement's really important to actually make sure you're surrounded by people and that you can keep doing the good fight.
You especially would know more than the average person, I suppose, about this topic, because you do advocacy around both climate change and youth mental health. How do you find that these two topics intersect?
Yeah, so I, like, my lived experience with mental health has primarily been anxiety and an eating disorder. So it feels like it shouldn't fit together, but it does, because a lot of the time you see the same barriers affecting certain groups and actually participating in activism and advocacy. Like, it is really hard for First Nations people of color to actually be involved in this advocacy a lot of the time, purely because, like, what's at stake? Cultural stigma, in the case of like protesting, police brutality has become a real thing. So in both sectors, it's this idea of justice that is ultimately at the heart of it and really fighting for that. And I think that's why climate justice is so beautiful, because it captures the fact that there are certain groups, like those who live in fire-prone areas, Indigenous people who, you know, have their land stolen from them, and we're currently speaking on stolen land, like those sorts of things, and keeping that idea at the center is how I see the intersection. And obviously, you know, climate change furthering anxiety, you see people in like flood-prone areas talking more and more about how it's affecting their mental health. You see farmers talking about that as well. And I think those conversations are really, really important.
Do you feel like eco-anxiety is kind of the natural response to what's going on at the moment? Like, would you encourage people to be taking a more positive or a different perspective on this issue? Like, how do you deal with these feelings, or how do you deal with the overwhelming problems that you're facing every day?
Yeah, I mean, I'm a big advocate for eco-anxiety to be actually on like our health forms and the mental health care plan, because I think it needs to be there. We're dealing with a climate crisis and it's only going to get worse, especially with our government's slow response. But I think it's also important to find different outlets to channel that through. And I think being part of a big group and knowing that you're with other people, that you're all fighting the same fight, is so, so powerful. I never feel more powerful than when I'm in a protest surrounded by thousands of people. So trying to find those spots where you can actually channel that into action, I think, is really important, because it's so easy with social media and everything to just get stuck in how awful everything is, but there is so much people power as well, and there are wins being made. I think that's something we don't talk about enough.
My next interviewee is a high school student who's already spent the last 2 years working in the climate activism space.
Hello, my name is Miki Inoue Palmer, and I'm the co-director of School Strike for Climate Fornicare. I got involved about 2 years ago when I was 14, and I was really keen to kind of get my hands into some kind of activist work, and I've been working at School Strike ever since.
Do you feel like you experience eco-anxiety? And if so, how do you deal with that?
Yes, absolutely. I think a lot of young people experience eco-anxiety. It's kind of what got me into School Strike to begin with. My experience with it is that I think I spend a lot of time engaging in politics, and so I'm reading the news a lot, and I meet a lot of politicians, and I think sometimes it gets quite overwhelming and you get quite worried about it. Especially, I think it's harder for young people because we're sort of also still learning to navigate the world around us. And so I didn't used to work with it so well. I kind of just sat there and stressed out about it. But now that I work at School Strike, what I try to do is I try to write down like 1 to 3 things that I can try and do to get rid of that feeling or make myself feel better about kind of a lack of inaction on the climate crisis in our country. So sometimes it'll look like email someone back for School Strike, and sometimes it'll look like go plant trees this weekend, or go pick up rubbish this weekend, or just something small on a practical level that I can do. And I think that just makes me feel like I'm not, you know, working against the climate crisis, because it, you know, that's a lot for one person to shoulder, but it makes me feel like I'm doing my best and like I'm trying to do something practical. And I think that makes me feel a lot better. But also sometimes it is just taking a step back from the situation and kind of acknowledging that, you know, I'm worried for a very valid reason, but that anxiety in itself isn't that productive. And I need to take a breath and just, yeah, kind of reflect on what I can do that's within my control and what I can't do that's not within my control.
From other people your age and from other people who go to your school as well, what are some of the attitudes that you've observed? Do you see that a lot of people feel anxious about the climate, or is that more so the case for people who do tend to get involved with climate activism?
That's a tough one. I think it is more noticeable in people who work in the climate space, but I think it's more of a correlation and not causation thing, where if you're more worried, you're more likely to get involved. But I think a lot of young people experience it who don't, you know, necessarily engage that much with politics or with the climate, but I think they don't necessarily know how to explain the way they feel or talk about that with other people. I know a lot of my friends didn't know how to kind of bring up the topic of climate anxiety until I kind of got involved with school strike and a lot of people started talking about it to me specifically. But I do think it depends a bit of a case-by-case scenario. I think young people have a lot of stuff on their plate, and some people maybe don't focus on the climate stuff as much as, you know, all the other things they're going through, which is understandable. But I would say on the whole, I would say maybe 50% of the people I talk to about climate anxiety say they've experienced it or say they've sort of felt that feeling, but they don't really know what it's called.
Would you encourage other young people to find a more positive way to approach this topic or look at this topic or get involved with climate action? Or is there a different way that you might encourage people to think about climate anxiety and think about kind of the overwhelming climate crisis, I suppose?
Oh, big time. I think it does kind of alleviate some of that stress, not fully, but I think it does just, you know, help you work through those feelings. I think climate activism for me is what I feel most comfortable doing. I think it's like the most practical for me. I've always been very interested in activism. I think if politics is something that you find really disengaging or really difficult to talk about, then something more kind of hands-on leaning, like lots of communities do tree plantings or, you know, beach cleanups or that kind of thing, I think that's a really good way to get involved on sort of a lower level that you can maintain over a long period of time.
Further to the topic of community and activism in response to eco-anxiety, I spoke with 350 Aotearoa campaigner Adam Curry, accompanied by his friend Sarah Gell, talking about the material impact of climate change for people across the motu.
Adam Taka Ingwa, I'm Adam. I got involved originally when a freak storm invaded our home during high school. And I remember the floods and the storms, you know, coming into the living room, and our neighbour was a kaumātua who, you know, had to be carried out of his house, and, you know, all the mana and the loss of respect that involves. And I remember that, you know, after that big flood, we met with the Minister of the Environment, who was also our local MP at the time, Nick Smith. And I remember talking to Nick Smith, I felt more hopeless than I did when we were literally putting sandbags in front of our home, you know, just seeing the absolute state of politicians not getting it and not understanding and just not caring. And I think after that, I thought, like, I never want to be that helpless again. See, and of course, most people who are being flooded by increasing weather events aren't able to, you know, don't have time, don't have capacity to talk. So I thought, if we have a voice, it's really important to use it. And that's how I got involved.
Hi, I'm Sarah Gell. I guess I'm just a young person that's interested in our future, and I'm involved in some food initiatives around our city.
Have you experienced eco-anxiety? And if so, how do you navigate that?
Yeah, well, I mean, I think the whole eco-anxiety thing, like, it's obviously a very real concept as we worry about, you know, the future of the planet that we live on. But it also, I think, gets really hyper-individualized, you know, and becomes about, you know, exactly me and me worrying about my future and me worrying about the climate stuff. Well, of course, you know, we're experiencing this as a collective, and some people are experiencing it far more than others. And so I think, yeah, absolutely, you know, of course, I worry about the future getting worse, and, you know, it's going to get much worse for me personally, but it's going to, you know, I'm much more worried and concerned about the way that, you know, it's going to get much worse for us collectively as a society. You know, we're seeing, you know, we know that X amount of tons of emissions equals, you know, 700 lives lost, and so we can pretty clearly associate just, you know, the emissions of an extra plane running to, you know, the emissions of extra lives lost. And so I think, yeah, sure, absolutely worry about, you know, the future and worry about anxiety and, you know, and just how things are going to be and how life's going to be and not be able to see family and friends anymore and, you know, see the places that we really love disappear and be vanished and be destroyed forever. But, you know, I think obviously it's a collective response because it's something that we're, you know, experiencing as a collective, and it's something that while, you know, we do experience differently, you know, we're all in this together. And I love that quote from Leah Watson, which is like, if you've come here to help me, you're wasting your time. But if you've come here because, you know, your liberation is is bound up with mine, then let us work together. That's what it's sort of about, right? It's like, yeah, we experience, you know, anxiety, each of us, but we work in climate activism because we know that, you know, we're all bound up together. And I'm not, you know, working climate change solely because I'm worried about Pacifica and, you know, Pacific Islands solely. I'm worked up because we're all affected by it by very, very different levels. And that's why, you know, we're all in it together.
I think young people are starting to see how climate change is directly affecting our food system, and we've just had a really clear example of that with the Wellington floods, and for that we had the flooding and the cyclones up north, like in Hawke's Bay, and that has a very direct effect on where we are getting our food from. But there are farms up in Wellington and neighbouring regions that are now out of action, out of production for at least 3 months before they can start selling produce again, because they have to prep the soils again and replant to see something 3 months down the line. And now it's kind of, this is in our peak growing period right now, so for them to have that cut really, really short, it really directly affects those farms that are already squashed by the duopoly of the supermarkets that we've got in New Zealand. These farms are too small for really good insurance as well, so that might mean the closure of a lot of farms across New Zealand. And these floods are directly affected to climate change. We can see that our water warming around our coastlines are just adding more water to our water cycle. So we're going to see more and more floods every year, which once upon a time that was a once in 15-year occurrence. And now we're seeing basically every year we're having a flood somewhere in New Zealand. So that's directly affecting us. And unfortunately, Māori and Pacifica and disabled are the most affected groups by food insecurity and lack of food resilience nationally.
What are some of the most common attitudes or responses, I suppose, to climate change, especially in its material effects for the communities across Aotearoa?
Absolutely, especially with how accessible information is now with our devices. I think youth now more than ever are totally engaged in climate change and what we can do to prevent further climate warming, what we need to do on an individual level, and then actually, you know, protesting against the system that we've found ourselves in as a community so that we can break those cycles and our big businesses and corporations feel the pressure that we have to do better as a society to prevent further climate change.
There's this weird thing about, you know, we're proximity to everything, right? You know, like someone who's scrolling on their phone and they're subjected to ads and then watching the climate disaster on your phone and then genocide in Gaza and then, you know, the best way to cook a nice lentil dinner. Like, it's, you know, like, I think that's what part of the anxiety is all about, is we're just sort of seeing the hyper-normalisation of this kind of disaster and threats and, you know, things, obviously in really real ways, but also just like you're being bombarded by information and news all the time, and it's like, it's hard to stay being human and hard to stay being sensitized to it at a time where, you know, you're just watching climate disaster advert, you know, and just like it's in your life all the time in a really sort of just like weird way.
In the face of what can be such overwhelming climate news, especially amongst all the other events around the world that we're exposed to on a daily basis, what keeps you motivated?
Well, I think, like, you know, I do live with this nagging sense of like ashamed hopelessness that we're not going to do it and our efforts are going to fail and the world is going to go down the drain. But, you know, while we've got every right to feel that, I think it's egoistic, right, to say that we know how this ends, you know. It's really egoistical to say that, yeah, sure, we're seeing a world where, you know, there's so much wrong with the world and maybe it's not going on the right track. But, you know, I love the words of Julian Agwan, who's an Indigenous climate activist from Guam, you know, and he always says that we refuse to engage in an all-consuming sense of despair, and we have unique capacity to resist despair through connection and collective memory. And I think that's like the people who despair the most, they're not saying our islands are drowning, this is the end, it's gone, you know. Like the Pacific Island Warriors say, we are not drowning, we are fighting, you know. And so I think maybe it does seem often that the world's getting bad and, you know, and we really worry about it, but I think we have to believe that, you know, collective memory and the big change of the past can help us imagine how change can occur again in the future. You know, we have had incredible transformational change in the future. We have gone out of disaster and come out at the other end, instead of being pessimistic and having an anxiety that, you know, and that pessimism thrives off anxiety, right? We need to be saying actually things can change. We can, you know, tax the rich and take that wealth away from the ultra wealth and, you know, funnel it to people in the Pacific Islands who, you know, who can rebuild lives. We can change the way we operate, and I think it's so important that we, yeah, sure, we do feel the anxiety and we need to acknowledge that and share it as a collective and, you know, do things that help us, you know, but we have to like make sure we put that in, I think, just like a context of we can win, we do have hope, and, you know, we do have community around us. The vast majority of people are feeling the same way, instead of people trying to feel locked in a box and feel like they're the only one.
I think what really makes me feel optimistic is that the work that I do and the work that a lot of my friends do in their organisations is working for positive change that is good for Te Tāiao and good for our food system, that's actually we're digging ourselves out of a hole. There are positive initiatives happening nationwide that I can see a really positive future for all of New Zealand.
The government has quietly rejected advice to set a much more ambitious long-term target for New Zealand's carbon emissions.
We are very proud of what we are doing to accelerate renewable energy in this country.
Brick by brick, we're dismantling it, mate. We've gone beyond this unicorn kissing view that only clean green energy will keep the lights on.
Does the Prime Minister understand that climate action is needed now, given these events today will be the most mild our tamariki will face in their lifetimes?
Well, I'll just say to the member, if she wants to support climate change, get on board with the program of backing RMA reform, backing fast tracks, that's actually getting renewable energy projects built quicker, back mining that enables the creation of EV and solar panels. Make sure that you get on board with what we're doing, because we're actually going to deliver net zero 2050. No problems, but we're actually going to grow this economy too.
Despite all the mahi of climate activists and community groups, the governmental decisions made in Aotearoa seem to be, at best, contentious. So the question has to be asked, just how good or bad are our climate policies? To answer this, I spoke with international climate policy expert Dr. Carly Green. Well, I wanted to ask you a bit about some of the climate policies and action that's being undertaken both domestically and internationally. I'll start with New Zealand. The government says that they're proud of their environmental policy direction, despite the calls for change and even a total reset from some environmental groups. To ask simply, are we headed in the right direction to effectively address climate change in Aotearoa?
Yeah, I mean, it's probably put simply, Sarah, but maybe not a very simple answer. So for sure, I mean, most countries can always do more. And if you look at basically the UNFCCC have some analysis of a country's national determined contribution, which is effectively the commitment that we're making towards 2 degrees target that we've set, or 1.5 to 2 degrees target that the global community has set under the Paris Agreement. And if you look at New Zealand's current status, we appear to be, I guess, not underperforming, but we're not doing enough is probably a good way to put it. And it's predominantly coming from a number of particular policies around our large emission sources. And so in New Zealand, that, of course, is agriculture. And there's some complexities around that as to why it's difficult, I guess, in the ag system to try and reduce emissions and maintain food security. But at the same time, there is quite a lot that can be done. And I think there's a bit of a missed opportunity here in New Zealand at the moment in the current policy settings to build more resilient, climate smart agriculture. So, yeah, I think there's probably one particular area where New Zealand, you know, could probably strengthen its policy position on climate mitigation.
To that vein, I wanted to talk about some recent examples of the government's environmental decisions, include reforms to the Resource Management Act, the Fast Track Bill, also include specifically to this lowering the methane emissions targets for farmers. Can you explain what impact these decisions have for New Zealand in our climate ambitions?
Yeah, so, you know, if we don't sort of incorporate climate impact into some of the decision making in around those policies, then it's super hard to incorporate that impact in the outcomes from those policies. So, for example, if for the fast track, if we're not incorporating what impact some of these projects under that framework will result in, then that sort of slips under the radar quite a lot and doesn't get really incorporated in any of decision making. It just gets reported in our national inventory each year, that which makes us further away from our NDC. So, you know, you can't change what you can't measure, as they say. And if you're not incorporating greenhouse gas estimation in your decision making, then you're not making decisions that result in an outcome we're after in the climate space. Yeah, I mean, I guess the same would apply for the Resource Management Act. Again, if you're not measuring it, you can't account for it, right? So, yeah, if it's not part of your decision making checklist, then it's not part of an outcome that is going to be a successful one for the climate.
How does New Zealand compare on a global stage on climate action, on mitigation and adaptation strategies, on upholding our commitments to climate targets?
We're in the sort of phase at the moment of reporting against those targets. So we've reported up our 2025 progress towards our commitments. Then again, there'll be another report in 2030. So these five-year reporting periods are super important to track progress against our NDC. At the moment, I mean, it depends on, and, you know, I guess it always depends on what sort of media you listen to or where you get your information from about whether or not we'll hit that target or whether we're going to fall short of that target. And at the moment, it feels like it seems we're going to fall short. Globally, there's some good examples of countries that will meet their targets and then some others also who won't. But on the whole, it definitely looks like emissions are at least stabilising. And in New Zealand, actually, we have, the last two reporting periods, look like we've stabilised our emissions. They're not increasing as much as they were in the past. And so this is a good sign that whilst we're not tracking down globally yet, and neither in New Zealand are we tracking down overall, but we are hitting what we call peak emissions, which is very encouraging in terms of trying to meet those temperature thresholds.
Climate solutions on a global level obviously require an extraordinary amount of cooperation. At the moment, I feel like we're seeing kind of worrying trends of nationalism or rising self-interest among states, among powerful states especially. Is this something that you've observed, or do you think that as they stand, our existing global structures are capable of producing the level of climate response that we need to address this issue?
I guess for me, you know, climate change can be quite politicised, and it has by many, many countries. And that can be quite noisy, I think, and quite distracting and also quite disheartening as well. When you see this sort of discourse happening and you know, this commitments and then no commitments and then backing down on these things. What I see more recently than, say, a decade ago is that a lot of the technology in the energy sector in particular has become actually cheaper and more secure, I suppose. So you can generate more renewable energy at home, so you get more energy security in some ways. That countries are moving towards decarbonisation sort of not out of commitment to climate response, but out of either financial or political stability, or, you know, trying to create a more stable trade environment as a result of some of the discourse, I think. So it's kind of like this weird sort of movement. And like we see that in China. Like, China's the largest CO2 equivalent emitter, and their emissions have stabilised this year, not because of any climate change policy that the government's put in place, but simply because they've transitioned their energy sector to renewables because it makes more financial sense to them to do that. And so we're seeing less of these political positions and noise around climate change affecting the actual emissions themselves. So for me, this is quite a transition point where, you know, sure, you can have a different position on climate. You can not support climate through your national policies, but you're probably doing something anyway because it makes more sense for your economy or more sense for your nation to decarbonise for other reasons. And so for me, this is a really big turning point.
On the topic of climate policy and news, my next interviewee is someone I knew would be brutally honest. Catherine Dyer was one of my lecturers a couple years ago and is now a lecturer at Victoria University of Wellington in the Faculty of Geography, Environment and Earth Sciences. I'm just going to go straight into quite a big question to start with. As someone who is well in tune with climate change news and kind of understands what's been going on around the world with regard to climate change and climate action, I suppose, do you yourself have hope for the future in our current situation?
Yeah, like, my point of view is that the future is one of different probabilities or possibilities. And so I don't really see the future as being, you know, there'll be either a bright and happy future or there'll be a dark and terrible future. And in fact, I would say that those two probabilities are ones that I would not count in the first place. I think, you know, the future is much more likely to be some kind of combination in between. It's going to be some kind of shade of grey. So when you go, do you have hope in the future? I mean, yeah, there's all sorts of different outcomes that might happen. I don't know what's going to happen exactly. And so, you know, I think there's lots of futures that are more positive than other futures. I would just prefer to work towards the brightest ones that I can see as being possible, but also while being very aware of what are the worst things that can happen. And if I'm going to live through those futures, how should I prepare to navigate that?
How substantial is the change we need to be seeing in order for a positive outlook in this space to become a well-founded position or way to look at this problem?
Well, again, I would, you know, I'd kind of say, like, what your outlook is partly a factor of, you know, what are the possible things that might happen in the world, and partly your own perspective. So, you know, having a positive outlook is probably as much about personality type and how you think about things as it is about what's actually going to happen in the world. But if we're talking about climate change in particular, you know, what I'm expecting to see happen, yeah, I have a lot of concerns for the future in terms of, you know, we are facing a lot of potentially catastrophic risk coming down the line, and the amount of change required
try to prevent those from happening. I think there are certain risks that we probably can't prevent it at this point. There are things that are going to happen anyway. But that doesn't mean that you can't have a positive outlook for your own path through life.
Are there any trends in climate policy internationally or domestically that you'd like to highlight that you're particularly concerned about, or maybe on the other hand, that you're quite optimistic about in terms of what you're seeing?
I would say on the concern side, I'm worried about where things are going with international cooperation and things around the Paris Agreement. And I think a lot of people would join me in being concerned about the direction that that's going in. In terms of from a policy point of view, I think there's a lot of different worldviews and different ways of approaching things that are starting to emerge. And some of these are based on European perspectives, like degrowth as a way of changing the future. And other ones, there's things like Ubuntu, Eco-Swaraj, Bhuvan Vivere, are different kind of worldviews that come from different parts of the world and from different influence from different indigenous cultures that are much more relational in terms of how you think about the nature and the world and what's happening. And so I tend to favour myself a more relational perspective, which I guess you would say it thinks about the world in terms of, you know, the problems like climate change and biodiversity threats and things like that are signs of problems with our relations with each other and with nature. And so dealing with those things requires, I guess, more of a shift in terms of our cultural sense of where we are and what we need to do about things in the future. And that can be quite difficult to look out into the future and go, well, where is this cultural shift going to come from? When is it going to arrive? You know, and what are we working towards in that space? And I think it's very likely that that's not something that's necessarily in our individual control. When cultural shifts or changes in the zeitgeist kind of happen, you tend to not think that it's possible for them to occur. You might be fighting and losing and fighting and losing, and then one day you fight and win, you know, and things have just shifted a bit. And so I think it's important to be mentally prepared for that possibility.
Kind of speaking now a bit more to attitudes around this issue, I know that a lot of young people have kind of asserted that they feel like quite torn between really wanting to act towards a positive climate future and work in spaces of activism, for example, to really build the change that we need to see. But then on the other hand, they're obviously quite concerned for our future, and it does feel like it's quite an impossible problem to face. I was wondering, have you observed among students in your classes or as well as among other academics much of a presence of eco-anxiety or climate nihilism? Or otherwise, how would you categorize the kind of conversation and attitudes around climate change and climate action and how they've evolved, I suppose, in your observation?
I mean, I think when it comes to climate anxiety, it seems rational to me to have some level of that. Like, I don't actually see that as a pathology or something to be fixed, because that seemed to me like a really normal response to some of the information and news that we get about climate change and biodiversity loss and all of those kind of polycrisis issues. I'm surprised when I meet people who don't feel any anxiety about that. That seems quite normal. And I think, you know, the reason that we have anxiety about those sort of things is because we're not supposed to ignore them. It's supposed to be something that makes you feel uncomfortable so that you are motivated to change something. And so to me, that seems normal. I find it quite interesting. I don't know if you have heard that there are a few things that President Trump in the US has, you know, cancelled, like research funding and so on the basis that it's creating climate anxiety amongst young people. His answer seems to be, well, if we don't tell them anything, they won't be anxious anymore. And yeah, I don't know. What do you think about that? That seems like a crazy approach to take, right?
Yeah, well, I mean, I'm quite involved in politics just in the nature of my job and what I do. But yeah, sometimes it feels like for a lot of people, that's the stuff that they want to be able to ignore, I suppose. Or it seems like if you're not scared about climate change right now, then you're either in the denial phase of whatever's happening, or maybe ignorance is almost a little bit of bliss in terms of you can't do anything anyway as an individual. You know, why bother trying? Is that kind of how you see it? Is that stance one that you think is acceptable in this day and age in terms of what we are facing here?
I don't know if I would put it as acceptable or not acceptable. I think of it more in terms of, is it useful or not?
Mm.
You know, so, and that's where I kind of get this whole sense of, oh, if we don't talk about it, if we don't look it directly in the eye, then maybe it won't come for us, you know, which just, that just seems like it prepares you very poorly for what you're going to potentially be dealing with in the future, and gives you no chance at all to try to change or have some impact on what the possible outcomes are, at least for you and your life and in your world. So to me, it doesn't seem like a very useful way to approach things.
I mean, in that sense then, what kind of role do you see or do you want to see, especially young people, but I don't think that this is just the responsibility of young people. I think, what role do you want to see anyone in New Zealand or anyone across the world, I suppose, playing in response to this crisis? I mean, do you think that we have a genuine shot at turning things around, or is it just a matter of trying anyway?
First of all, I would say I think there is specific dimensions for young people that it may be different for people my age. You know, I think anybody who I guess is under the age of 30 has grown up with climate change and biodiversity loss and all of these things being issues that have been talked about constantly. But at the same time, they're growing up in a world which has kind of said to them, these are the norms or the narratives about how you're supposed to live your life, which is that you grow up and you get your education, you get a good job and you buy a house, you have a family and, you know, you do all of these expected things, even though we know that all this other stuff is going on the other side. And I think even that is kind of a little bit, there's cognitive dissonance about that. It's almost a little bit schizophrenic in terms of we're telling you about all of these terrible things that might happen, but we're also telling you just the expectation is that you're just going to go on with your life as if they're not happening. I think it's a weird time, you know, for people to be growing up in, and I think that that does have an impact on people. And so I don't have any negative judgment about what people's choices are in that. But I just think that there are some choices that are more useful than others. And I think there's always uncertainty about the future. There's always a range of possibilities or probabilities about what could happen in the future. And there still are, you know, there's even within the science, there's a lot of deep uncertainty about aspects of climate change. We have, you know, sometimes it seems like we know all that there is to know about it and we can build models that will show what will happen with certain levels of emissions. But even within those models, there's a lot of stuff that's not in there and that we still have a lot of deep uncertainty about things like tipping points, and, you know, there's still some uncertainty around climate sensitivity and these sort of things, which what that all adds up to is, and there are also likely to be feedback within the natural system that we don't know about yet, and they could either make things worse and make things happen more quickly, or they could slow things down. So even within what we do know, there's quite a bit of uncertainty about what's going to happen when and how that will unfold. And I think it's just normal for humans to, you know, the thing we hate the most is uncertainty, right? We want to know that if we do certain things, we'll get certain outcomes, and there are some guarantees around that. And so, you know, whilst there always has been uncertainty in the future, it feels like more of it at the moment. And there's more information about potential ways that it could go, really could go potentially quite badly. The other thing that I quite often think about is this idea of collapse. And so it feels like this big, very final event, you know, like, oh, we are headed for civilizational collapse and then that's the end of things. And I don't know, I tend to think of it as we're potentially going to be living through a number of collapses. There could be, you know, in fact, we already have. There are ecosystem collapses happening now in some places and some ecosystems, and there will probably be more of those. There can be economic collapses. There can be, you know, like a whole range of different collapses, and they may even be connected to one another in some way. They may be interdependent. So when that word comes up, rather than thinking about, oh, you know, collapse means the ultimate bad outcome and it's the end of the world, it probably isn't the end of the world. And in fact, most of us are probably going to live through some form of collapse. And so it makes sense to me to start to think about, well, how do I want to live through that? Not just, you know, what can I do to avoid it, which that may be part of the conversation as well, as can we push that out into the future a bit further, or can we do something that changes the nature of how that collapse happens? But also, how will I live through it? What do I need to know? What skills do I need to have? How can I live, you know, the best life that I can, even if that's what's happening? So I think conversation around collapse needs to kind of open up a little bit, and we need to talk about the fact that it's not a one-off event that happens one time. It's probably going to be a series of events that we will live through.
In speaking with Catherine, I was put onto a colleague of hers at Victoria University by the name of Gerhard Rees. Gerhard is an environmental psychologist who has researched and published extensively on the topic of eco-anxiety. Taking this opportunity to learn more about the phenomenon from a clinical perspective, I start by asking Gerhard about his expertise in this field.
Well, I've been doing environmental psychology now for, I think, close to 15 years, if I'm not mistaken, maybe 20. And my main focus has been the attitude-behavior gap and understanding the individual, the social, the collective, and the systemic processes that predict pro-environmental behavior and that can explain why we act and why we don't act. And one part of that in the last years has been research on climate and eco-anxiety. That's the emotional response to things like climate change. And I'm also very interested in this intersection between nature and mental health and how all that also feeds into, sustainable action, sustainable attitudes.
You've been involved in a plethora of research relating to eco-anxiety, including an experimental study on young people relating to how they cope with the climate crisis. Is there anything throughout your time that you'd like to highlight in particular on how people should be able to cope with these feelings or something to that end, I suppose?
Yeah, I mean, climate and eco-anxiety, these are relatively fresh or relatively new concepts in terms of scientific understanding, scientific investigation. Actually, the research, really like empirical research, came up on that topic maybe in the last 5 to 10 years. Yeah, and I think the important part are first that we have to take these emotional responses seriously. There has been a phase where more and more young people were reporting emotional distress, emotional responses in terms of climate anxiety, eco-anxiety to the devastating planet. And this is not just, it's quite sad that the polar bears are dying. It's really like an emotional response that goes to the core of some individuals. At the same time, it's important to say that it's not pathological like other anxieties or other fears. Quite a rational response based on what we know with regards to climate and what's happening to our planet. And the third thing is there's very little research so far on how to deal with these anxieties, but it's always important and always good to talk about it, to have the room, the space, the opportunity to talk about it. And also getting together with other people, with like-minded people can help buffering the stress that you might experience from eco or climate anxiety.
I'm interested in this space to kind of talk about how it's quite a tricky problem to deal with the climate crisis, because there's not a lot of certainty about what is going to happen in the future, what 20 years is going to look like, what 50 years is going to look like, or how much things will be different. We understand obviously that we're not heading in such a great path, frankly, but I mean, I know that there are statistics about the decline in young people having kids, or a lot of young people thinking about whether they should have kids, or if they might have to relocate, or if they might become a climate refugee, or if they might otherwise suffer from the climate crisis. I know that, and obviously previous generations have had other massive world problems like wars have maybe caused these same feelings about an uncertainty for the future. But do you think that this is a reasonable response to the climate crisis, and how do you think that young people should navigate this?
Well, that's a very good question. I'm not sure if I'm in the position to say whether a response is reasonable or not. That's an individual decision in many parts, but there's certainly some sort of understanding to people thinking about whether they want to have kids or not. There's very little research on that, depending on which survey or whatever you look at. There's sometimes a certain percentage of people saying that they are so much concerned about their future that they really consider not having kids, but you can't really say, 40% of the population of below 25 don't want kids because of the climate crisis. It's not that clear cut. I would always be careful with certain numbers, because the desire for having kids, it also changes over the lifespan, even if you do not think about climate change or something. So if you ask a 23-year-old person, it's easier to say, no, I don't want kids. But if you ask the same person when he or she is 35, it might be a different story. So I would be really careful in interpreting such data when they are out there. And yeah, I mean, in general, with regard to the climate crisis, of course, it's reasonable to think about where you want to live, what you want to do with your life, of course. And I personally would probably not build a home directly at the sea anymore, or buy a home in an area that is prone to landslides or whatever. So I think there's definitely reason to think about where you want to live or where you want to invest in a home.
Young climate activists that I've talked to have spoken about this tricky balance between using hope for a better future future perhaps as a motivation to act and to get involved in trying to create change, while on the other hand, becoming overexposed to negative climate news and getting fatigued or burnt out by the work of climate activism. Do you think there's a way to balance this, especially in the modern world where we can't really escape the amount of information that we have access to at all times on the climate crisis?
Yeah, that's a really tricky question. I mean, for climate activists and activist groups, it's always difficult to find this balance between providing information and providing reason for the cause, while at the same time doing something that draws the attention to them. So if you do some like really hard things that really disrupt everyday life, they lose a lot of support, these groups. We've seen that with I think they were called the Last Generation group, at least in Germany, where they had a lot of attention, but not a lot of support because it disrupted everyday people and not the big players. Yeah, finding this balance is quite difficult. And as you just mentioned, the fatigue due to all the information out there, that's something I think at the moment we can't really do anything about it because we've got all this information, we got all the media, everybody's connected, so we can't get rid of that. The question for climate activists is how to raise attention. And this usually works with creative ways, especially in the social media, with creative campaigns. But at the same time, we've observed that in the last years with the wars in Ukraine and with a living cost crisis and with all the things going on in the world, that it's really, really hard to develop support for one single cause, although climate change is more than just a single issue. It's an overarching issue that will affect a lot of these crises.
My final interviewee is someone familiar with just how daunting news can be. Nick Henry, policy and advocacy lead at Oxfam, works every day amidst the great challenges faced globally. And after listening to numerous perspectives about the impact of climate news exposure on eco-anxiety, I figured he'd have some insights for young people interacting with these issues too. To start with, Oxfam regularly produces reports about the extent of the climate crisis. One element of this coverage in particular that I wanted to focus on is the contribution toward that crisis by the ultra-wealthy, by billionaires and by global corporations. A few headlines, for example: a billionaire emits a million times more greenhouse gases than the average person. A person from the richest 0.1% produces more carbon pollution in a day than someone in the bottom 50% produces all year. And the richest 1% have blown through their fair share of carbon emissions for 2026 in just 10 days. When seeing this kind of news as an individual, it does make the problem feel quite overwhelming and any small action feel quite futile. What is the kind of message about climate responsibility that you are wanting people to take away from headlines like these, I suppose?
Yeah, well, thanks for that great summary. And I think one of the messages that we wanted to convey with that kind of analysis is to really interrogate this idea of a carbon footprint that, as you may know, was an idea that was created by oil companies and their PR firms to try to make us feel individually responsible for things like the climate crisis. And it shows the limitations of that kind of thinking when we see how disproportionately responsible the richest and the biggest corporations are compared to the impact that ordinary people in any country have. That's not to say that we shouldn't do what we can, you know, as individuals, but one of the, I like to say, and it's not an original line, the best thing that we can do as individuals is to find ways to act collectively. And by underlying the disproportionate harm that the rich and corporations are doing to the climate, it is emphasizing that these are structural, systemic problems that require collective solutions. It's not something that we can solve as individuals by recycling more or doing all those good things that I would encourage everyone to do if they make you feel better and if they give you energy to put into the fight, you know, knowing that you're reducing your own impact on the planet. That's good. If it gives you the motivation to support more systemic solutions, then we definitely need both, but we can't stop at the individual level. We need to address collectively those serious problems, and inequality is one of them.
In your work, do you often come up with or come up against attitudes of climate anxiety or fatigue or even resentment from others? Or do you feel maybe a little bit of burnout yourself in this space? And how do you deal with those feelings?
Oh, absolutely. I think it's quite prevalent in the background for a lot of us, actually. And we do need to be careful with how we present climate issues only in terms of bad news, because that can create fatigue, I think, especially if people don't see a way for them to make change or have agency in the process. So there's a balance of having a realistic view of things, which is, you know, not great, and realising that we can make a difference, we can change things for the better, and we actually can't afford to give up. So we need to find ways to stay hopeful, because that's the only way that we'll be able to make things better, or at least not as bad as they would otherwise be.
Yeah, I wanted to share a quote here from Jonathan Franzen. He wrote in The New Yorker on this topic. He said, "If you care about the planet and about the people and animals who live on it, there are two ways to think about this. You can keep on hoping that catastrophe is preventable and feel ever more frustrated or enraged by the world's inaction, or you can accept that disaster is coming." I feel like that kind of sums up this idea of climate nihilism that I've been trying to get at, and that I think that has been reflected in what I've heard from people that I've spoken to so far. How would you respond to this statement, though? Do you agree with his position?
I'm not sure. I think that a lot depends on what we mean by that last statement, that disaster is coming. I think that, you know, you could even go a step further and say the disaster is here, we're living in it. But I would also say, and this is not a particularly optimistic statement, I would say that however bad things get or are likely to be, they could always be worse, right? And so even if we think that disaster is inevitable, there's always a scenario in which it could be that much better or that much worse in terms of the harm that it's going to cause to people. So even if we think that a disaster is coming, that it's here, that it's going to get worse, we're still, I think, morally obligated, and there's still actually a very hopeful choice that we can make to reduce that harm, to take as much action as we can, to fight for every, you know, fraction of a degree that we can prevent of global warming, because every fraction of a degree represents probably millions of lives at this point and a whole lot of suffering that can be avoided. So I don't think that despair is a morally justifiable option. And I also don't think that acceptance, if it leads to complacency, is an alternative. I think that they amount to the same thing, which is inaction. And we need action because, you know, to put it pessimistically, things could always get worse. So the flip side of that is that we have an obligation to make things better if we can. And I think that we can.
To that point, I've heard an argument kind of spoken about how it's almost a privileged stance, I suppose, to be able to ignore what's happening or to be able to go about your daily life in the face of the climate crisis, because there are a lot of people, for example, climate refugees, who are already facing the consequences. And that kind of brings me to this concept of justice, which is something that I saw is quite a central part of what Oxfam stands for. And this idea of climate justice, kind of talking about how inequality and a lot of other issues intersect with what is going to be the consequences of climate change, that we're not all going to feel it equally in the same ways, and that there are a lot of different factors that are going to weigh in on that. I was wondering, how do you think a sense of justice could potentially help maybe drive people towards this meaningful action as individuals or even working in collective groups, like you've said?
Yeah, that's right. I think that climate justice, most broadly, is a response to the central injustice at the heart of the climate crisis, which is that the people and communities who are feeling the worst of the effects already are vastly disproportionately those who have contributed the least to the problem. So it's the poorer communities, whether it's in Aotearoa or other richer countries, who, when there are flooding events, people who live up on, you know, high ground and newer houses tend to do better, and those who live in the low-lying areas tend to do worse. And we know in Aotearoa that the communities who suffered the most from the Auckland floods were in the low-lying areas of South Auckland. We know that some of the communities who suffered the worst of Cyclone Gabrielle were in remote or rural communities, and a lot of Māori communities were really hard hit. And those patterns are repeated all over the world. So we don't have to look globally. We can see that in Aotearoa, and climate justice is a real problem for us here as well. But if we look to our nearest neighbours in the Pacific, we see that problem magnified, where entire countries like Tuvalu, who have done negligible amounts, have really not contributed to the problem of global warming because their emissions per capita are actually lower than what would have been required to keep within safe atmospheric limits, right? So they have not contributed to the problem of global warming, and yet their existence as a nation is being threatened by climate change. So that's the core injustice. And so climate justice would be to work against that injustice and to do so in a way that amplifies, centres the voices, acts in solidarity with the voices of those most affected. So it's not a new idea either. I think that it comes from a long tradition of environmental justice campaigning, which recognises that not only in climate harm, but in environmental harm more generally, the communities that are affected tend to be the poorer, the more marginalised, who suffer from pollution in their neighbourhoods and loss of livelihoods from degradation of land and fisheries, but also in urban areas who suffer the most from air pollution or lack of clean water. So there's a strong connection between environmental and racial justice, between environmental justice and economic inequality, economic justice as well.
So it seems that eco-anxiety is something that a lot of people feel. But to return to my earlier question, does that mean optimism in the face of climate change is totally futile? I don't think so. At the end of all these interviews, I asked what message each person had for young people experiencing eco-anxiety and some of the ways it encouraged people to respond to those feelings.
I think the biggest one is to kind of fall back on your communities and talk about it with other people because it makes you feel less alone.
If you have these feelings of eco and climate anxiety, get together with other people and talk about it and get yourself into a position that you can feel efficacious.
It could be artistic practice or it could be finding ways that things that are sometimes individual, presented as individual solutions, like reducing waste or improving your transport options. If you find ways to offer those as a community, they can be much more radical.
I think a really big one is getting involved in community initiatives that make positive change, a direct way that you can actually start to ease some of your anxieties by seeing how you can really make a difference as an individual on a community scale.
Trying to reconnect with some of the reasons why I'm working in climate change, so being closer to nature. I think that's helped me build my own resilience to keep going.
And ultimately just, you know, whether we meditate or we reflect or we pray or we talk or we sing or whatever we do that helps us process it, the important thing is to process it and to do it as a community instead of just sitting at night feeling hopeless, feeling like the world's going to end and there's nothing I can do about it and no one else feels the same way I do.
You're not imagining it and you're not alone, and it's okay, in fact it's necessary, to look after yourself and not to take on all of the problems of the world all of the time.
I myself, as Gerhard, I can't stop the climate crisis. We need to get together with other people who have very similar ideas, similar values, similar plans, so to say.
There is quite a lot of bad news out there, and we see things happening that are actually a result of climate change at the moment as well, which is something new that I didn't deal with when I was first starting out. It was kind of all conceptual or, you know, modelled, and now we're seeing it actually play out. And so I think the key thing is to surround yourself with people who are looking to make change and understand what change looks like for you.
Also just reading to and listening to stories about how people have resisted, have turned the needle on climate, talking about stories about climate resilience, about the Indigenous communities who are creating climate solutions in their communities.
I think our generation is one of the loneliest or something is what research is showing as well. And it makes sense as to why we feel so jaded, so like done with everything.
We feel most hopeless or most despairing when we feel isolated and when we feel helpless. And finding forms of collective action is, I think, one of the best antidotes to both of those feelings.
It is possible to make a difference at a larger level than yourself if you work with other people together.
So I think knowing that you actually still do have power and that there's community groups out there which you can join and work towards. I know that sounds cheesy, but honestly, being around people is the best way to work through eco-anxiety.
It's nice these days to be able to talk about it, because I think that's one of the main things where I've been able to build most of my resilience around dealing with this sort of what can be quite bad news most days.
We don't have any choice about the world that's been left for us, but we have a choice about how we act and how we work for a future and the world we leave for others.
You have responsibility for what happens in your world and in your relations, and you should take care of those irrespective of what everybody else is doing.
Hope is the best strategy, I think, to make a difference. Despair helps no one. So if you find that scrolling your social media feed or the news is getting you down and contributing to despair, it's okay to switch off. It's okay to focus on positive solutions. You don't have to torture yourself, but you can make a positive difference. And that's what I'd encourage everyone to focus on.
That concludes this Beeline episode on eco-anxiety. A special mihi to all of the interviewees, Australian climate activist Varsha Yajman, Wellington School Strike for Climate director Miki Inui Palmer, 350 campaigner Adam Curry and food resilience advocate Sarah Gell, policy expert Dr. Carly Green, Victoria University of Wellington lecturer Catherine Dyer, eco-psychology professor Gerhard Rees and Oxfam policy lead Nick Henry. Ka kite.
Thanks for listening to Beeline, your 95 BFM news podcast, delivering straight up news.